The city is safe now that they're here. I'd rather be unsafe with you than unsafe on my own. And I don't want Eastus eating one of the barmaids without a really good reason.
I glanced toward Mike. He put his hands up and said,
Ryan already said he was going to ask you. I told him it was your call.
But what do you think? I asked. He'd acknowledged that this was my operation. I could be magnanimous. Mike lowered his hands, looking serious.
I think we need all the muscle we can get. And I can cook for four as easy as I can cook for two.
Given that Ryan and Eastus were both Therianthropes, I was pretty sure Mike was going to regret saying that. This wasn't the time to point that out. I turned back to Ryan. As long as you can be subtle about moving your stuff over here, you and Eastus are both welcome to stay. Part of me wanted to add, and so is anybody else who wants to come. The sensible part of me, the one that understood that this was about to become a war zone, stepped in and didn't let the words get out. Ryan grinned, relief obvious.
I'll go tell Eastus. Thanks a lot, Vary.
Don't thank me until you've spent your first night trying to sleep through the mice, I said, but I let him hug me when he stepped closer, and I hugged him back with equal fervor. There's something to be said for keeping your friends around you when things get bad. It may not be good for their life expectancies, but it sure is hell easier on the heart. My phone rang. I pulled away from Ryan, offering him one last smile, and dug the phone out of my pocket. The call was coming from a blocked number.
Hello?
Verity, it's Sarah.
You owe me. Do you understand how much you owe me? Does your tiny, fluff-filled little head have the capacity to comprehend the volume of O that you now bear on your skinny little shoulders?
I laughed. Artie found the address?
Artie found the address, Sarah confirmed. Artie then spent an hour grilling me about why I wanted to know. Do you have any idea how bad I am at lying to him?
You're probably the only cuckoo in the world who can say, I'm a bad liar, with a straight face, you know. I sat down on top of an ammo box.
What did you tell him?
That you'd explain later.
About 12 times. And then I told him that if he didn't stop pushing, I was going to start crying, and then neither of us would get anything done.
He's really unhappy, Vary.
I'm sorry. I really am.
But you said he found the address?
Sarah made a frustrated sound. I'm texting it to you now.
You were right. The credit card used for the rental is registered to an address downtown. It's an apartment, though, about the size of yours. I don't think Dominic's going to be keeping the entire covenant there.
No, but he may have left something that we can use to figure out where he's gone.
I paused. Speaking of which, don't bother going by my apartment. We just finished moving my stuff out of there. I'm going to see if I can get the internet working where I am now, and I have cell service.
Wait. We? Said Sarah, voice going suddenly suspicious. Who's with you?
Uncle Mike's here from Chicago. I had to hold the phone away from my ear to keep her delighted squeal from piercing my eardrum.
Sarah, volume! Sorry, but tell Uncle Mike I say hi, okay? I'd ask where you were, but you probably shouldn't tell me over the phone, so I'll just beg you to be at least a little bit careful, and try not to get killed.
I'll do my best. I briefly considered telling her to get out of the Port Hope, but decided against it. No one who wasn't attuned to her would be able to remember where she was, and much as I hated to consider it, that included Dominic. She was safest if she didn't move. Stay inside tonight, okay?
Okay.
She sounded relieved. That made two of us. We exchanged goodbyes, and I hung up. The little yellow envelope that meant I had a text message appeared at the top of my screen 2 seconds later. I tapped it with my thumb, and it opened, displaying a Midtown address. According to the clock, it was almost 6. The sun would be setting soon. I straightened, slipping the phone into my pocket.
Hey, Uncle Mike, I think I need to go out for a little while. Can you get things set up here?
Depends. Are you going to go do something stupid that your folks would want me to forbid you to do?
Nope. And it's not like you can forbid me to do anything anyway.
I smiled winningly. I'm just going to break into Dominic's apartment and see if I can find anything to tell me where he's keeping the covenant while they're in town.
Oh, is that all?
Mike waved a hand dismissively.
Pick up some eggs while you're out. I'll make omelets in the morning. Also, write down the address and leave it by the door. If you're not back in an hour, I'll go over to have a chat with your young man.
Any chat, Uncle Mike described in those terms, would probably involve a crowbar.
Sure thing, Uncle Mike, I said, and turned to head for the nearest stairway. If I was going to do this, I was going to do it my way, and that meant that step one was getting myself away from ground level. The dragons had been living in the meatpacking district for so long that their renovated slaughterhouse was surrounded on all sides by buildings whose tenants probably had no idea what was in that sealed-off courtyard. New York is an old enough city that it has more than its share of odd architectural quirks like that. Little streets that lead to nowhere, little courtyards that technically aren't accessible unless you know the secret steps to get you there. I stopped on the edge of the slaughterhouse roof, looking around me as I assessed my position. This was my neighborhood now. I might never see the apartment I'd been illegally subletting again. The thought was oddly sobering. Even if I survived, my time in New York was almost up. The deal I'd made with my family was for a year. At the end of that, I was supposed to choose between cryptozoology and dancing. I had 1 month left in my original plan. When this ended, I was either cutting ties with the cryptid community, or I was going home. I tried not to think about that too hard as I backed up to the middle of the roof, got myself a running start, and leaped. Some people will tell you that gravity is a cruel mistress. I think they're missing the point. Gravity isn't cruel. Gravity is exactly the same for everybody. Covenant, price, or neutral party. Gravity doesn't care. Once you give yourself over to the essential forces that govern the universe, your choices are plummet or learn how to control your fall. After years of effort, I had learned control. The buildings around the old nest were still mostly unfamiliar to me. I'd never been what you'd call a regular guest back when the dragons lived here, and I certainly hadn't been swinging by on a regular basis since. But I'd been free-running through New York long enough by that point to be at least a little comfortable traveling blind. I grabbed hold of a fire escape as I fell, letting my own momentum snap me to a stop, and then sending me swinging upward. Energy likes to be used, and so I used it, turning the half-swing into a full swing that deposited me neatly on the next level of the fire escape. From there, it was just a matter of running along the building ledge until I could leap again, landing safely on the next roof. I gathered speed and certainty with every transition. My muscles were loosening, body falling into the familiar dance of playing chicken with gravity. I've been free-running since puberty was just a scary specter in the rearview mirror of my life, running up on me like T-Rex in the first Jurassic Park. I've long since passed puberty, and a bunch more milestones I wasn't looking for, and through everything that's changed, free-running has always stayed the same. I appreciate that. I also appreciated the fact that getting to Dominic's address involved several stretches of city that I was comfortable with, allowing me to take the time to confuse my route by doubling back, using unnecessary shortcuts and long cuts, like shortcuts but designed to make the trip longer and more confusing, and generally messing around. If someone tried to follow me, or tried to use some kind of tracking spell to figure out where I'd started from, they were going to find it a much taller order than originally assumed. New York is seen as a pretty big city, especially by people who look at the population size and try to imagine a world where all those people actually fit. In reality, the island of Manhattan is fairly small. It's just compact, with enough people for a dozen cities all stacked on top of each other. That makes it a freerunner's dream and a monster hunter's nightmare. The city's cryptid population would know the rooftops and sewers as well or better than I did, leaving the Covenant of St. George grasping at shadows as they tried to figure out where their targets were going to stop. Home field advantage is a good thing, if you know how to use it, and if you're not overly committed to the idea of playing fair. Personally, I've always thought that playing fair was another way of saying play to lose. I'm more a fan of my grandmother's motto, play for keeps. If I was going to get involved in the Covenant's little game, I was going to come out the winner, or I was going to die trying.
The address Artie had provided was to a nondescript live-work building that looked like it had last been renovated sometime in the early 90s, when all the dot-com kids were totally in love with the idea of working themselves into an early, if lucrative, grave. Dominic's apartment was on the 19th floor. That worked out well for me, since the building was only 23 stories high. A little air is a nice thing to have. A lot of air can lead to plummeting. Most of the time, I prefer to do my running without a net. Nets just slow you down. Sometimes, however, even I have to admit the wisdom of having a little something to hold on to. That's why I always carried a climbing harness when I thought I might need to perform a little friendly breaking and entering. I measured off rope based on the floor where the apartment was supposedly located, leaving myself a few extra feet for maneuverability. Once that was done and the rope was set, I tied it to one of the building's heat vents, checked the climbing belt twice to make sure it was secure, and stepped off the edge of the roof onto the empty air. The air obligingly failed to support my weight, and I dropped 40 feet straight down, only to be brought up short by the elastic ties connecting the rope to my harness. I went limp, letting gravity have its way with me. That was the best way to avoid any unwanted broken bones or dislocated shoulders. Physics can play nice, as long as it feels like you're playing along. Antimony calls that particular move pulling a Gwen Stacy, and mutters imprecations about how she's going to wind up short a sister one of these days. Antimony reads too many comic books. Once the rope stopped swaying, I sat up and looked around. I was dangling about 2 feet below the floor level of a nearby balcony. I swung myself over that way, reaching out to grab the rails as soon as they came close enough. Then, I pulled myself laboriously upward, finally sliding myself onto the balcony. The small child who was standing behind the sliding glass door leading into the apartment blinked at me. I blinked back, too surprised to do anything else. Slowly, he opened the sliding glass door. I said the first thing that popped into my head. "Didn't your parents tell you never to open the door for a stranger?" "Superheroes aren't strangers," he said, with calm matter-of-factness. I must have looked puzzled, because he explained, "You flew onto the balcony. Strangers don't fly. If strangers could fly, I'd never be allowed outside. So you're a superhero. Like the man next door."
"Like the..." "See, that's who I was coming here to see," I said quickly. "We're supposed to be having a team-up. Can you tell me which way his balcony is? It's sort of hard to aim precisely when you're heading for something the size of a building." The little boy pointed solemnly to the balcony to the right. "Great, thank you." I boosted myself back onto the banister, intending to jump. Then I paused. "Oh, and hey, kid, there are bad superheroes, too. So you really shouldn't open the door, even for people who can fly." Most human threats were unlikely to attack from above. That didn't do much to eliminate the cryptid ones. "Okay," said the boy, and closed the door.
I guess when a superhero tells you to do something, you do it. Leave it to Dominic to preach secrecy and caution to me, and forget to consider whether or not his neighbors could see him from their balcony. I smirked as I jumped back down and swung over to his apartment, grabbing hold of the balcony rails and pulling myself up for a second time. This time, no small children greeted me. Instead, the sliding glass doors granted me a view of a sparsely furnished, utterly deserted apartment. "Jackpot," I murmured, and started squirming out of my climbing harness. After the last of the buckles was undone, I used a carabiner to snap the harness to the balcony rail. That way, I'd still be able to reach my rope if I needed to make a quick escape, but I wouldn't be wandering around the apartment looking like the victim of a badly considered bondage. The kid from next door hadn't reappeared on his balcony. I decided that was a good thing. No one wants people watching their breaking and entering, especially not when they're as rusty as I am, and moved to try the door. It slid open easily. I stopped, blinking. "Okay, that was anticlimactic," I muttered. Dominic must not have considered the need for exterior 19th floor security. If we both survived this, and we were on speaking terms when everything was said and done, He and I were going to have some serious talks about that. That, or this was all a trap. I stayed where I was for several seconds, weighing the possibility that he was playing me against my need to know what was inside. In the end, common sense was solidly voted down by the rest of me. I stepped inside. My father always says that you can tell a lot about a person by the way they live when no one's watching. My brother Alex, for example, didn't do laundry for 3 months when he went away to college, because that was how long it took for him to run out of clean shirts. Sarah generally lived like she was totally unaware that the physical world existed. Antimony alphabetized her knives. Apparently, Dominic lived like he was expecting to be gone tomorrow, and didn't want to leave too much of a mess for the next people who passed through. There was something almost tragic about the bare wood floor and the empty IKEA-issue shelves. What little furniture he had was clearly window dressing, purchased because it was expected of him, and then practically unused. I moved through the apartment like a ghost, opening every drawer and cabinet that I passed. The coat closet was filled with weapons, ranging from a longbow and three quivers of arrows to an assortment of pole arms that had clearly become part of the standard equipment back during the Covenant's dragon-slaying days. The pantry held nothing but ramen noodles, canned chicken, and generic macaroni and cheese, the kind that never looked like food, no matter what you did to it. The fridge was a little better. At least it had a few cartons of takeout Chinese food. I recognized them as coming from the Chinese place we always went to together, on our rare date nights. Maybe he didn't know anything closer. The medicine cabinet in the bathroom was packed with first aid supplies, both mundane and magical. Band-aids and gauze pads, over-the-counter painkillers, and powdered basilisk bones, antibiotics and anti-venom, even some Tylenol 3 with codeine. All the things your modern monster hunter needs if he's going to keep fighting. Once I had exhausted the rest of the apartment, I moved on to the bedroom. Dominic's bed was a twin-sized futon mattress without a frame, shoved up against the wall like an afterthought. Looking at it broke my heart a little bit. The Covenant gave him resources and access to knowledge stretching back for centuries. What it didn't give him was a single person willing to make sure he slept in a real bed and ate something more nutritious than shrimp-flavored ramen. "Damn it, Dominic," I murmured, and began searching the bedroom. I found what I was looking for under the futon, a sheet of paper on which was written a dockside address, the number for a car rental service, labeled, and another number, unlabeled. I straightened, folding the paper and slipping it into my belt.
"I couldn't tell you, but I could count on you finding a way to come and get it for yourself," said Dominic.
I stiffened. Then I turned, slowly, half convinced that he'd be holding a crossbow with his finger on the trigger. Instead, he was just standing there, hands in his pockets, looking faintly defeated.
"They're getting settled into our temporary residence," he said quietly. "I've been sent out for food. If you can recommend an authentic Italian restaurant that does takeout, I'd be very grateful. None of the places I go will meet their standards."
"Dominic," I began, and stopped, not sure how to continue. "I'm sorry I broke into your apartment, probably wasn't going to cut it." A very small smile crossed his face.
"You found the place faster than I expected you to. I was actually stopping by to pick up a few things."
"Like what?" I asked, before I could stop myself. "There's nothing here to pick up. You might as well be living out of cardboard boxes."
"I threw those out months ago."
His smile faded, expression composing itself.
"Verity,
are you okay? These people from the Covenant, they're not hurting you or anything, are they?" It was a stupid question. I didn't know what else to ask.
"Why would they hurt me? They think I'm one of them."
"Are you?" Another smile crossed his face. This one was sadder and died even faster than its predecessor.
"I don't know, Verity. I wish I did."
"I'm not in my apartment anymore."
"Good. I'm glad. You aren't safe there."
"You wouldn't tell them where to find me, would you?"
Dominic sighed. I don't know. If I knew... There are a great many things that I don't know right now. It's not a pleasant sensation.
I'm sorry. I stepped toward him, offering my hands. After a moment's hesitation, he took them. If you need me, call. I'll try to come.
If I call you, run. There's no guarantee I'll be doing it for the right reasons, or of my own free will.
He leaned forward to rest his forehead against mine.
Either I'll have betrayed you, or they'll have compelled me. It's not worth the risk.
I wish...
I know.
He ducked his head long enough to bring his mouth to mine. The kiss was long, and slow, and sweet in a way that was difficult to describe. Kisses on the eve of battle almost always are. When he pulled away again, it was only to murmur,
I have something I need to tell you. I should have told you before. I shouldn't tell you at all.
What? I blinked at him, puzzled.
I love you, Verity Price. Regardless of how things go from here, please remember that. There was a time, however short, when I was a boy, and you were a girl, and I allowed myself to love you.
He smiled ruefully.
I'm sorry.
Don't be sorry. This time I was the one leaning in. I kissed him hard, hard enough that when I pulled away, my lips felt bruised. Covenant boys and Price girls. It's sort of the natural order of things at this point, don't you think?
Nature is cruel,
Dominic murmured, and tugged his hands free of mine. I let him go.
You can't come here again. Once they're settled, they'll begin patrolling, and this is technically Covenant property. They'll feel free to come and go here as they like. I can't risk them stumbling over you because they stopped to resupply themselves.
I don't suppose you can give me their names, can you? Just so I can find out who we're dealing with? Dominic hesitated. Come on, I said, a bit more sharply. I'm the one who's standing solo here. It's not betraying the Covenant to tell me who I'm going to be fighting against.
He sighed. All three are from the British arm of the Covenant, possibly because that was where I had the bulk of my training after my parents died. The men are Peter Brandt and Robert Bullard. The woman... Verity, please understand that I had absolutely no influence in choosing who would be sent with this team.
I know that. I frowned. Why?
The woman's name is Margaret Healy. She's your third cousin. And if there is anyone in the Covenant who hates your branch of the family more than she does, I have yet to have the misfortune of meeting them.
I stared at him. Oh, I said finally.
Well, shit.
Dominic sighed again.
My thought exactly.
Chapter 11. Nobody loves you like family. Nobody hates you like family either. That's why it's so important for us to stick together. If we don't, we're going to wind up hunting each other down.
Enid Healy. The rooftops of Manhattan, heading back toward the meatpacking district. I ran across the rooftops faster than I ever had before, managing to make the leaps and changes in elevation needed through a combination of skill and raw terror. Terror is a powerful motivator toward perfection. Even so, it was something of a miracle when I reached the meatpacking district without falling to my death. Margaret Healy. The woman who was almost certainly going to kill me was named Margaret Healy. Her friends probably called her Peggy or something, if being a member of the Covenant of St. George left her any time for making friends. She was probably a really nice person in her off hours, and she had all the training, resources, and focus she needed to take me down. I was so screwed. That thought clung to the front of my mind like a Pacific Northwest tree octopus clings to a branch as I grabbed the rail of the nearest fire escape and jumped off the slaughterhouse roof.
By swinging hand over hand, I was able to make it to a low enough point to let me safely drop down to the brick courtyard attached to the nest. I landed harder than I would have liked, still too distracted by my encounter with Dominic to balance myself right. Pain shot up my heels and into my calves as my legs protested the impact. "Walk it off," I muttered, and straightened, starting toward the slaughterhouse door. The pain lingered for the first few steps, but then it faded, except for a few distant grumbles that would probably be bruises in the morning. There's a reason I buy my Tiger Balm in bulk. When I was sure that the pain was on the way out, I broke into a run, and kept running until I was inside the nest. The door echoed as it slammed closed behind me. There was no one there. "Uncle Mike?" I looked around before cupping my hands and shouting. "Uncle Mike, if you're here, we need to talk."
"He is not present."
The voice came from behind me. I whirled to find Eustace standing less than 2 feet away, her head cocked to the side, a quizzical expression in her dark brown eyes. She was wearing her hair loose for once, hanging around her round face in heavy black waves, and she had a bright blue feather fascinator clipped above one ear. She was probably the most stylish Wahila in the world, for certain values of stylish. She was still a Wahila. I took a step back. "Personal space, Eustace, remember? We've talked about this."
"My apologies."
She also took a step back, creating an acceptable bubble of emptiness between us. Eustace was a co-worker, a friend, and someone I was perfectly happy to share a converted slaughterhouse with. Sometimes she was also a giant man-eating wolf bear from the primal heart of humanity's nightmares. I like her a lot, but having her stand too close can still remind my reptile hindbrain that part of her will always view me as prey.
"Your not-relation and Ryan are currently not present."
"Where are they? I have news."
"They said we required provisions, and Ryan wanted to inform Kitty that we would be accessible via telephone only for the duration of the crisis."
Eustace suddenly smiled, showing teeth that were too sharp to be entirely human.
"I am very pleased that we will be staying here. It makes Ryan feel better, and increases the potential for carnage."
"Oh, trust me, the potential for carnage is very high right now," I muttered. Then I paused, an unpleasant thought striking me. Eustace, not to be indelicate or anything, but what is it that you eat?"
"I can eat all types of human food, although I am very fond of pizza and chicken wings. They're crunchy."
"Oh, good," I began. But Eustace wasn't done.
"I am also fond of alley cats, small dogs, and urban rodents. I make an excellent rat casserole. Ryan says I am a natural."
Eustace perked up.
"Would you like me to prepare dinner?"
"No," I said, wincing. "But there are some people I think you need to meet before we do anything else." Freed from the confines of their front hall closet, the Aeslin mice had been busy. Their raiding parties had returned with several dead rats and a codal, a feathered snake 4 feet long. It was probably a towhill, one of the smaller, less venomous varieties of feathered serpent, judging by the color of its plumage. The mice had been in the process of skinning the thing when Eustace and I arrived, and I didn't feel like interrupting dinner preparations to find out. It was funny in a way. If Dominic had killed the codal, I would have lectured him for days about harming cryptid wildlife that wasn't dangerous to the human population. But the codal was one of the natural predators of the Aeslin mice, and if they wanted to eat it before it could eat them, I wasn't going to hold it against them. The entire colony stopped their preparations for the moving feast when Eustace and I walked into the office, and a sea of tiny heads turned in our direction, tiny black eyes glittering in the overhead light. More heads poked out of the walls and the converted Barbie house, which was now surrounded, I saw, with smaller lean-tos and half-built ceremonial buildings. This wasn't just a feast. It was a barn-raising, Aeslin-style. All the more reason for me to get this taken care of quickly. "Hello, colony," I said.
"Hail,"
replied the mice, with one voice.
Eastis jumped.
Bertie.
She stepped closer to me. This time I didn't remind her about personal space.
There are mice.
Yes. I don't want you to eat them, so it seemed to me that introductions were in order. She gave me a sidelong look, expression clearly implying that I might well be insane. I'd been seeing that face since I was old enough to get sent home from kindergarten for telling fibs. To their credit, my parents had grounded me, not for telling fibs. I hadn't. But for being stupid enough to tell my teacher about the time my grandmother shot the boob fairy with a load of buckshot. All my teacher heard was that things were taken care of. And they were. I became a much better liar after that.
"The mice are talking," said Eastis patiently, in case I had somehow failed to notice.
"True," I agreed. "Colony, this is Eastis."
"Hail Eastis!" declared the mice.
Eastis jumped again. Then she turned and glared at me, like this was all an elaborate trick that I was staging for her benefit.
"Make them stop talking," she demanded.
"I can't. No one can. If I had that power, my sex life would be a lot less complicated." I decided to take mercy on her. Always show mercy to the apex predators when possible, and cleared my throat before saying, "In the interests of maintaining local harmony, I invoke conversation for cake." The mice cheered once before going eerily silent. Eastis stepped closer still, until I could feel the heat of her skin. I managed not to step away. A small figure appeared on one of the wooden paths winding around the former Barbie dream house. It made its slow way up to the very top of the structure, leaning heavily on its staff with every step. I didn't offer to help. The High Priest was proud. If he wasn't, he would already have stepped down, letting a younger, more enthusiastic mouse take his place. I wouldn't shame him by acting like he couldn't make the walk on his own. When he reached the top of the house, he stopped, coiling his tail tightly around his feet as he turned to face us. He kept hold of his kitten-bone staff, letting it support his weight. His whiskers were forward, signaling his curiosity.
"What do you wish, O priestess?" he squeaked.
"Hello, my friend," I said. I indicated Eastis. "This is Eastis, of the Wahila. She'll be staying with us here while we take care of things. I wanted her to meet the colony."
"Before there could be bad decisions," said the High Priest.
He bowed to Eastis.
"Milady Carnivore, welcome to our home."
The other mice took this as an invitation to cheer. The High Priest silenced them all with a stern glare, and one rap of his kitten-bone staff against the roof. He might be old, but he still ruled his people with an iron paw. Eastis, meanwhile, was looking at him with unabashed curiosity.
"You are talking mice," she said. "Mice are not meant to talk." "Yet talk we do," said the High Priest. "Truly, you are wise to approach such a complicated theological question on your very first introduction."
He rapped his staff again. This time it was a cue, and the colony's cheering went unabated. "They are hyper-religious," I explained to Eastis quietly.
"They worship my family."
"Oh," said Eastis, looking puzzled. She looked at the High Priest.
"If you worship her, what do you do with me?" "We ask that you do not eat us, Milady Carnivore, and offer to share the spoils of our hunt with you," said the High Priest. "We will feast well this night, on rat and bat and feathered snake."
"I would like that," said Eastis.
"Do you always talk?"
"Sadly," I muttered. The High Priest pressed his whiskers forward.
"You are truly a lover of complex theological debate," he said, sounding delighted. "We will enjoy your company."
"As long as that company doesn't involve eating my family's mice," I said, to get us back on message. "Eastis, please don't eat my mice. They're very important to me, And besides, it's rude to eat anything you've been introduced to. Eastis pondered this for a moment before she said,
I will not eat any mouse that speaks to me, or that is caught within this room.
Thank you, I said.
May I stay here and partake of the dead rats which they have offered me?
I grimaced. Maybe. I looked at the High Priest. Eastis is not human, and does not share my dietary restrictions. If she dines with you, will you make this a religious ritual? Because I won't eat rat for you, no matter how important you think it is.
The High Priest slicked his ears back in evident amusement.
No, Priestess, he said. This will be the Feast of the Wahila with Religious Questions, and will be celebrated only when a Wahila is present to dine with us.
In that case, yes, Eastis, you can stay and eat dead rats with the mice. Eastis beamed, evidently delighted.
Perhaps I can help with the gutting.
General cheers and the sound of Eastis's laughter followed me out of the room. Sometimes my life really is indescribably weird. With Mike and Ryan off getting supplies and Eastis eating dinner with the mice, there wasn't much that I could do with myself. I went to the office I'd claimed as a temporary bedroom and finished unpacking my weapons, lining them up along the walls until I stopped feeling quite so transitory. A price girl can live anywhere as long as she has her boots, her knives, and her guns. That's a lesson we picked up from my great-grandmother, Frances Healy. But near as I can tell, it's been true for every generation of our family since the dawn of time. Our last name may have changed, but our essential nature has always remained the same. Even I could only spend so much time fussing with the placement of ammo boxes and throwing knives. Once that was over, it was time to turn to the much less pleasant of my planned chores, making some calls. Not every cryptid has a telephone or wants one, but all smart urban cryptids are plugged into the local gossip network. The boogies and the dragons knew about the impending purge. That was a start. Between them, they had connections to 2/3 of the city's cryptid population. With a few calls, I was able to tip off the harpies for the aerial cryptids and the nixies for the aquatic ones. I couldn't reach any of the gorgons in my contact list, but hopefully between Carol and Joe, they'd hear what was coming. There are 3 species of gorgon. Carol could warn the lesser gorgons. Joe could warn the Pliny's Gorgons. No one was going to warn the Greater Gorgons. But then again, Greater Gorgons are generally what you're warning people about. They'd be okay if the Covenant was armed with anything short of a tactical nuke. Once I was out of numbers and tired of being screamed at by people who were convinced that this was my fault, I went out into the main room and spent another 20 minutes placing dartboards around the area, hanging them off support beams and at odd angles on the walls. They'd work for target practice in a pinch, and this was not the time to let myself start getting sloppy. The slaughterhouse didn't have many windows. The windows it did have were narrow things set high to the ceiling, where even the most industrious burglar, or assassin, would have to really work for the kill. Even so, I found myself wishing Antimony were there. Not to stay. The situation was too dangerous to wish on my little sister, no matter how many times she'd tied me up when we were kids. I just wanted her around long enough to set trip wires and alarms on all the unexpected entrances. She had an eye for that sort of thing. Without her, I was going to have to improvise. So, improvise I did, scaling bits of exposed pipe and door frames to place mason jars full of nails in front of every window I could possibly reach, and a few I probably should have left alone, since a fall at that angle could have left me with broken bones, or worse. It seems to be an immutable fact of nature that any time you move into an empty building, no matter how recently it was vacated or how thoroughly it was cleaned, you'll find roughly a dozen forgotten glass jars in cabinets and closets. No one knows why. It's a mystery that may never be solved. I was trying to figure out what to do with myself next when my phone rang. I jumped before checking the readout. It was a blocked number, which meant Sarah, and answering.
Hello.
I thought you were going to turn the internet on.
Sarah sounded peevish.
You haven't checked in, you haven't been online, and I was starting to worry.
I sighed. Mom put you up to this, didn't she?
Your father, actually, but it's still true. I hadn't heard from you. The Covenant's in town. I was worried. Then I thought, wait, there are these magical pocket telepathy machines that we all carry? And I dialed your phone. Ta-da.
The last was delivered, not with a flourish, but in a dust-dry deadpan. You're a real comedian, Sarah. I produced a throwing knife from inside my shirt and flicked it at the nearest dartboard. It hit a little left of center. What's really on your mind?
How did it go with Dominic?
My second throw went wild as her words forced me to finally think about what I'd been trying to avoid thinking about. I hate circuitous logic. Closing my eyes, I said, good and bad.
How good?
He loves me. Sarah paused.
That's good, right?
I just said it was good.
Do you love him?
That is a large and complicated question, affected by a great many outside factors, most of which are beyond my control.
Gosh.
She sounded almost impressed. Then,
that's pretty much bullshit. I mean, even I can tell that's pretty much bullshit, and I have the relationship sense of a wombat.
You just have biology issues. Your own species is made up entirely of sociopathic assholes, and Artie doesn't know what to do with a girl who actually likes him rather than just liking his pheromones. Sarah sighed deeply.
Tell me about it. Dominic loves you? Like, he said he loves you? In those words.
He told me he loved me, right before he told me to run, because he wouldn't be able to protect me if the Covenant came back.
Oh, and it gets better.
How does it get better than that? There are 3 Covenant representatives in town. I should call Dad to get him to run dossiers on them. That would mean telling him who they were, and that would mean telling him that we were up against family. 2 of them, I didn't recognize their names. They're not from any Covenant family I know.
Uh-huh, said Sarah slowly. Why do I get the feeling that behind door number 3 is something that's going to explain your sudden radio silence?
The 3rd is Margaret Healy. There was a long moment of awed silence before Sarah said,
Wow. When you decide to get into a bad situation, you don't mess around, like, at all. Your boyfriend, who loves you, is totally hanging out with your evil cousin.
She's not necessarily evil, just misguided.
I'm on her magical hunter, kill-it-on-sight list, so I think I get to call her evil if I want to, Sarah countered.
I sighed, but I didn't argue. She had a point. According to the family record, there was a time when the Healys were the pride of the Covenant of St. George. They were faithful, they were devout, they bred like rabbits, and once they were aimed at a target, they killed without hesitation. They were the perfect monster-hunting assassins. Dozens of my ancestors were canonized in the annals of the Covenant, heroes and heroines of the war they fought on mankind's behalf. They were demonized at the same time, recorded as monsters in the history of the world's cryptids. There are 2 sides to every story, and history is a story like any other. It wasn't until my maternal great-great-grandfather came along that any of the Healys questioned the party line. And when they decided to start asking questions, they did it the way the Healys had been doing things for centuries, enthusiastically, and with suicidal levels of commitment. It's funny, but I sometimes wonder what the hell great-great-grandpa Alexander was thinking. Every other defector we know of was motivated by something. Love or death or a great epiphany in the field that changed everything. Great-great-grandpa did some research. That was all. He was trying to learn better ways to kill monsters, and what he found was something entirely different. He researched further, and when he didn't like the things he found, he did more research. And then, he not only threw away everything he'd ever worked for, he convinced my great-great-grandmother to do the same thing. We may be the only people in history to defect from their religious order, not over a point of faith, but over footnotes.
great-great-grandpa was able to convince his wife to leave the covenant with him, but he couldn't convince his parents, or his siblings, or his cousins. The Healys in America were never more than a tiny group of exiles, one that eventually changed its name. There are no Healys anymore, just Prices and Harringtons. The Healys in Europe, on the other hand, are legion, and they hated us right up until they stopped believing we existed. We were the ones who besmirched the family name. We were the ones who had to pay. Sarah's voice brought me out of the family history and back into the present.
You realize this means they suspect you're here.
What? I shook my head vigorously, not caring that she couldn't see me. Dominic didn't tell them. If he had, they would have taken me already.
He didn't tell them, but they suspect something. The Healys haven't been in the Covenant's good graces since the defection. So why would they send one on this kind of mission, unless they wanted her to look for signs that the family was still around?
You sure do know how to make a girl feel safe, I muttered.
Feeling safe isn't what matters right now. Staying alive is.
I heard something beep behind her.
That's my alarm. I need to get to class. Do you want to come by my hotel tonight? We can talk about what to do next, order too much room service, and try not to freak out.
It's a date, I said, and hung up. It was time to give in to the inevitable. It was time to call my father. The less said about my call home, the better. By the end of it, I knew that the Brants were an old Covenant family from Wales and were mostly men of action, which meant that I didn't need to worry about Peter hatching any clever plans against me. The Bullards were more recent additions to the fight, having signed up shortly before the Healys left. We didn't have much data. Most of what we did have came in with Grandpa Thomas, who referred to Darren and Cassandra Bullard as right twats. Somehow, I didn't find that encouraging. And Margaret Healy was, of course, likely to recognize me as a relative and shoot me on sight. Not in the head. That would have been too easy, and Healy women have always been good at resource management. She would shoot me in the kneecaps, and be able to grill me at length about the location and strength of the family in North America. And then she would hunt us down, one by one, and finally finish what the Covenant failed to accomplish in my grandparents' time. She would be the one who killed the traitors. As one of the traitors in question, this didn't strike me as a good way to spend my time. The end of the call was as predictable as the rest of it.
"This changes things very," said Dad. "With your cousin in town."
"You mean my biological cousin, not Sarah?"
"Yes, exactly. With your cousin..."
"And not my uncle by adoption, since you're the reason Uncle Mike is here."
"Verity."
"Oh, and not all the people who depend on me. The ones I promised not to run out on because they were going to need my help with the Covenant in town. The only one who matters is Margaret. Right? None of the rest of the family. Just her." Dad sighed heavily.
"I'm worried about you, Pumpkin. I'm not ready to add you to the family history."
"You won't, Dad. I have good people here with me, and some of them are even human." Mike and Ryan walked in just in time to catch that comment. They looked at me quizzically, their arms loaded down with bags of groceries. I waved for them to give me a second. "I can't run out on New York. I'm needed, and what kind of price would I be if I ran the second it looked like things were getting bad? I have to stay, and you have to stay far away."
"I wish you weren't there, Verity."
The misery dripping off his words was palpable.
"I wish we'd told you no when you said you wanted to go and spend a year dancing. We should have told you that you couldn't go."
"I'm a grown woman, Daddy. I would have gone anyway. At least this way you know what's going on. Uncle Mike just got back, and I need to fill him in. Can you catch Mom up?"
"I can. And Verity, if things get really bad, come home. Don't worry about whether you're followed. We can handle it if you are. Just get Sarah and get out."
He paused before adding,
"If you can't get Sarah, trust her to follow on her own. You just run."
He sounded guilty. I couldn't blame him. The idea of leaving her behind had never even crossed my mind. "I'll be careful," I said, and hung up before he could say anything else. Tucking my phone back into my pocket, I turned toward Mike and Ryan, who were watching me with almost matching expressions of amusement on their faces.
"What was that?"
asked Mike. "Dad sounding the horns for Judgment Day," I said. "Eustace is upstairs having a celebratory feast with the mice. I just spoke to Sarah. She's fine, and I'm supposed to go check on her later tonight."
"So what's the problem?"
asked Ryan. "The problem is that I'm no longer the only biological member of my family in this city," I said, and turned to focus my attention more on Mike, who would understand the importance and the danger of what I was about to say. "One of the Covenant representatives is a woman named Margaret Healy. She's a cousin."
"Oh,"
he said.
"Crap."
I nodded. "Yeah. There's a lot of that particular sentiment going around. So now the question is, what are we going to do about it?" Chapter 12. If you get yourself turned to stone, you are grounded for a week. No TV, no dessert, and no trips to the range. Do I make myself clear? Evelyn Baker. The Meatpacking District, which is nicer than it sounds, inside a converted warehouse, trying to come up with a plan that doesn't get everyone killed.
"I don't get what the problem is," said Ryan. "Verity's this chick's cousin, right? So why can't she just explain that this city is her territory and that the Covenant needs to leave? Family should respect family, even if they're on opposite sides of a war."
Tanuki have always been very family-oriented. Large portions of their culture were based around tracking who was related to who and through what sort of path, although that had less to do with filial affection and more with their having a limited gene pool. No one wants to find out after the fact that the cute guy you've invited back to your den is actually a first cousin. It was that devotion to family that got a lot of Tanuki killed when the Covenant came to Japan. The Tanuki just kept rushing in to save the ones who'd been captured, and got themselves slaughtered in the process. Being able to turn yourself to stone doesn't stop the men with sledgehammers. "It doesn't work like that for humans, Ryan," I said, and chucked another throwing knife at the nearest dartboard. It embedded itself deep into the cork. "We keep track of our relatives more so we'll know where to send Christmas cards and who to hate than because we're planning to help each other out."
"Hey, now!"
Uncle Mike stopped cutting the lasagna long enough to shake his spatula at me. It was store-bought. The lasagna, not the spatula, although the spatula probably came from a store somewhere, and the smell rising off the baked meat and cheese concoction was heavenly.
"Family is a good thing, too. Don't you forget about that just because you're busy being freaked out over some cousin you didn't even know existed before yesterday."
"Even knowing that the Covenant probably sent her because she's family? Nobody sniffs out a Healy like a Healy, and we've only been Prices for 2 generations. If I was going by Grandma Alice and the pictures I'd seen of Great-Grandma Fran, I could call myself a Price as much as I wanted. I was still going to be an obvious Healy girl to anyone with eyes."
"Even knowing that she's here because she's family. Being a Healy doesn't give you magic powers or anything. Maybe makes you a little stubborn. The stubborn has to be genetic. And then there's the luck thing. But none of that guarantees that she's going to trip over your hiding place, and you've got a lot more allies in this town than she does."
Uncle Mike dished a healthy serving of lasagna onto a paper plate.
"Now eat. You're too thin, and you're going to worry yourself into getting even thinner."
"I'm a professional ballroom dancer," I said. "Thinner is a good thing." I still took the lasagna, moving to sit down at the nearby table. The dragons had been living in this nest for long enough to have paid, probably grudgingly, for converting the employee break room into a serviceable kitchen. Between the stove, the fridge, and the microwave Ryan and Eustace had brought with them, we had sufficient facilities to keep us all fed for the duration of the siege.
"Not when you have to wrestle a lindworm out of its hole, it isn't. Eat."
Uncle Mike turned and pressed another plate into Ryan's hands.
"You too. Is that girlfriend of yours going to want some when she finishes partying with the mice?
Probably, said Ryan. Eastis is a black hole in a lacy pinafore.
And other phrases that have never before been uttered. I stabbed my lasagna with my fork. It wasn't as satisfying as certain other kinds of stabbing would have been, but it was what I had available at the moment. We need a plan.
Don't die, suggested Ryan.
We need a better plan.
Don't get seriously injured, said Uncle Mike.
I eyed him. Are you going to take this seriously?
This is serious. This is a serious situation.
I paused, scowling. Only now I've said serious so many times that it's starting to sound funny to me.
Damn it! We need a plan!
The Covenant doesn't know where this place is, so that's a start, said Mike.
Dominic has never been here, and he doesn't like free-running, so he's unlikely to have ever followed me, I agreed. The others don't know yet that I'm someone they should be following, so that buys us a little time. We need to be careful coming and going, but we were already planning on that. And the mice make remarkably good spies. If anyone comes sniffing around here, we'll know. For the first time, Ryan looked faintly uncomfortable.
They're not going to be, you know, announcing themselves to people on the sidewalk or anything, are they? Because talking mice will convince the Covenant that there's something up with this place pretty darn quick.
They're actually better at being subtle than anyone gives them credit for, I assured him. When you see them around me, they're in a safe place. They know that they can be themselves here. Out in the world, they practice stealth and actual cunning. If they didn't, they would have long since run out of Aeslin mice.
That's a relief, said Ryan.
I paused. Actually, there's something to be said for using Aeslin mice as spies. We've done it before, when we felt that we really had to. The mice are happy to have something they can do to help the gods, and some of them inevitably wouldn't make it back from their holy mission, because they were mice, and what I was contemplating involved sending them out into a world where practically everything was bigger than they were. It was still one of the best ideas I'd had so far, and from the thoughtful look on Uncle Mike's face, he thought so too. He brought his plate and sat down next to me.
It would be a good way to find out what the Covenant was up to, if we could find a way to sneak some mice into their headquarters, he said. Didn't the mice come before your family left the Covenant, though?
Yeah, but they came with my great-great-grandmother Enid when she married into the Healys, I said. Margaret might not know about the mice.
There's an awful lot of wiggle room in might.
I didn't have an answer for that. I was saved from needing one when Eastis appeared in the kitchen doorway.
I smell lasagna, she announced. You will share. Hi, sweetie.
Ryan waved his fork in her direction.
Food's on the stove. Did you have a good time with the mice? Yes.
Eastis started toward the lasagna, detouring only long enough to kiss Ryan on the cheek.
They are very pleasant company. You have rat breath, said Ryan, wrinkling his nose.
Eastis looked pleased.
Yes, she said. I know.
She dished half the remaining lasagna onto a plate, bringing it with her as she moved to sit down next to Ryan.
Have we determined the best method for driving the Covenant from our territory yet? Will carnage be involved?
We are still working on that, I said. We have numbers, now, but if this whole team disappears without a trace, the odds are good that the Covenant will send more people to find out what happened to them. Maybe we can disappear a second team, but can we manage a third? Or a fourth? Eventually we're going to wind up being the ones who don't have the numbers in our favor. And then the Purge of New York would be able to begin in earnest.
So what do we do right now?
Right now? I guess we watch and see what they do. Once we know what we're up against, we'll be able to counter it. I jammed my fork into my lasagna.
I hate waiting. Doesn't everybody?
Asked Mike. I sighed heavily. That's what I'm afraid of. We're waiting because we want to minimize the damage. Well, the Covenant doesn't have anything like that to worry about. They can move whenever they want to, and we have no way of seeing them coming. Ryan took care of the dishes while Uncle Mike walked around the slaughterhouse, double-checking my traps and doubtless setting a few of his own. We'd all need to walk carefully from now on. That was good. It would keep us on our toes. As for me,